everyone. This is Alexander Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and today is August 25th, 2015. We've almost made it through the entire month of August, unscathed for the most part, but man, have the energies been absolutely wild. This has been a wild ride, and one in which I don't know if I want to go through this again. As many of you know, I returned from East SETI Speakers Convention, and I was absolutely blown away because I ended up suddenly moving, and that really just kind of derailed me and my regular way of operating. So I just want to once again thank everyone for being so understanding and compassionate, and we're working really, really hard to try to get caught up. So just hang tight. We should be getting caught up by the end of the week. With that said, if you're new to Galactic Connection, please check out our blog. It's galacticconnection.com, and there's a tab on there for the daily blog. You can access 365 days a year for alternative media, and we do cover a lot of the conspiratorial stuff, but we combine it with spirituality. The whole purpose of Galactic Connection is to be the bridge between what's really going on behind closed doors, but also through maybe a metaphysical perspective. So that's interesting because who we have on today, we're on very much the same plane there. Anyway, if you are new to our products and services, please check out all of the Galactic Essences, which are personally made by myself. I work very closely with Saint Germain. And you can also check out our implant removal processes, which have become very world famous, and they really do put you on an incredibly new sovereign path. Highly recommend you check it out. For those of you that are across the seas, that are English is not your first language, we do transcribe each and every one of our interviews so that you can read it at least in your own language. So you can check that out under the BBS Radio tab. And last but not least, we will be launching a new series of courses called The Temple. And so stay tuned. That's going to be coming pretty soon here. We also have literally a flurry of other announcements to make, but I'm probably going to save that until next month. So with that said, just sit back. This is going to be some kind of media information. I'm sure many of you are familiar with Winston Shrout. He is an amazing guy. I had the privilege to not only hang out with him at East SETI, but to actually share a house with about, what, 8 or 9 of us there?
It seemed to be in and out, 8 or so.
Yeah, and met his lovely wife, Pat, and just can't say enough good things about him. And because of that, I felt very strongly to bring his information forward. He hasn't done a ton of interviews, huh? You haven't done a whole bunch, but you've done a lot of presentations on your own.
No, actually, I've done quite a few interviews.
Oh, have you?
We tried to post those on our YouTube section there, but as certain issues come up on certain areas, people are wanting information about my opinion about this or that, so I try to give it as far as I can. So we've done a few here and there.
And do me a favor, Winston, you may want to get a little bit closer to your speaker on your laptop. Maybe move your chair forward a little bit. There you go. Cool. Thank you. And I just want to give you guys a flair of how Winston's mind works, because I read this and I loved it. And I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but it says, the truth is we live in a very complicated commercial world, a world so misunderstood and confusing it's easy for people to get into trouble without knowing how or why. My goal is to help folks understand how commerce really does work, so that they have the knowledge and the confidence to safely navigate through the commercial maze. And I love the fact that you used the word navigate, considering we're talking about admiralty law here. Originally, the term commerce rightfully defined the interchange and exchange between states or nations. However, over a period of many centuries, the definition of commerce has expanded to include trade between individuals. We're going to get into why is that so key today. Lacking the ability to overcome the rules imposed and enforced by others, men and women have had to adapt by learning the ins and outs of complex commercial systems. They have learned that in a world of fiat money, it's all about paper in every respect and every aspect of life. So anyway, the mission of Winston Shrout Solutions and Commerce is to provide material that encourages, supports, and assists as many people as possible in completing their commercial education. And as they venture out into the world of commerce, at least they'll be able to be aware of some of the relevant history, the educational material available, and some possible remedies that may be useful in navigating through this commercial maze. Winston does address topics such as bankruptcy, courtroom procedures, facts and agreements, failure of consideration, refused for cause, unlawful detainer, habeas corpus, bonds, corporate franchises, benefit privileges, the difference between legit title and lawful possession, and much, much more. I don't know how much more exhaustive that list can go, but I'm sure it can.
Much, much more, trust me.
Yeah. So anyway, with that said, please do me a favor as you're listening to this. You may want to access his website at WSSIC.com, which stands for Winston Shrout Solutions and Commerce.com. You can also type the whole thing out and get access to his website. He has a second site called exocommerce.net, which is really cool because he's taking all this legal information that he knows and the history behind it, and he's giving you the scope through a more galactic perspective.
Yeah.
Right?
Correct.
So anyway, he has also established himself as really an authority in the philosophy of redemption of law, and we're going to kind of dive in today just on some facts and some basics. Some of this may be a repeat for some of you, but he and I've discussed it. We may end up having to do more than one series just because there's so much information. Now, I know my audience, Winston, are extremely savvy. They're very, very on top of things. They're very enlightened. And I would have to say that the majority of them have been very heavily researched individuals. Right. So I think the first thing out the door would be, can you give everybody a background of who you are and what promulgated you to start being so passionate about researching all of this?
Yeah, I don't know how far back I would need to go, but as luck would have it, starting around 1998, I was able to retire from my occupation as a construction worker, had worked as carpenter, welder, and all those kind of things. In the real world, I wasn't a paper pusher. So anyway, as luck would have it, I was able to retire from that, which gave me a lot of free time. So I started to started on this journey at that point. And when I first started this, you know, the most people were studying law and all those kinds of things, you know, from a statutory perhaps point of view, perhaps a common law point of view, and so forth. And then all of a sudden, the study class I was working with, we changed directions real quick when we started to get information on what has become known as commercial redemption. Mm. Now, there's a lot of things that go into this for understanding. Perhaps we'll get into some of those elements a little bit later. But in the beginning, back in the beginning, we had very little information to work with. And as luck would have it, I just stumbled onto some individuals who I learned from who were very solid, very, very solid individuals in knowledge and so forth. And then one of the first things that came to my attention was to understand this kind of information. You had to go metaphysical. You just had to, because the comprehension of some of these principles and techniques simply are unexplainable from a third dimensional point of view. Mm. The reason I say that, I think we go back to Einstein, says you can't fix a problem using the same tools that caused the problem. And so if we have third dimensional problems, we have to kind of withdraw to a different place and take a look at them. And so that's one of the first things that I learned, was that the solutions and the situations had to be looked at from a different dimension, from a metaphysical point of view, which fit right in well with me, from the perspective that, you know, from the days of my youth when I was a small child. I was raised in a church-going family, and unlike so many others, I paid attention. And so over the years, I became a student of theology, you might say. I looked at the spiritual aspects that were presented by the religious community and so forth, utilized many of those techniques over the years and so forth. So when it came the opportunity to correlate commerce metaphysically, it was not a difficult shift at all. So then for a long period of time, maybe for, let's say, maybe 3 or 4 years, I was studying, running into individuals that had, you know, different problems here and there. So I would try to work with them, try to assist, you know, to try to resolve some of the problems. And then after a while, word kind of got around. I was asked to speak different places, some seminars, maybe California, New Mexico, basically down in the Southwest, you know, where I was located at that time. And so then once I became kind of popular, and I think a lot of people enjoy the way I present information. It's fairly simplistic. I try to put as much humor into it as possible.
Yes, you do, especially because it's so meaty, you know.
Oh, yeah. You got to have a little laugh about things now and then. And then I always use this, what I call the hillbilly shtick, and that is to put people at ease. Well, I am a hillbilly, but aside from that, I try to put people at ease that this is not as complicated and as difficult as what people might think. If a hillbilly can figure it out, then anybody can figure it out. That's the position I take, you know, to help people, because one of the first things that I learned as an educator, particularly in this field, is I had to undo people's thinking so that they could see this, because we have been trained. I was trained. I mean, I spent 16 years in public schools, and so I was trained to look at things from one point of view. But to get past that, and going back to, you know, Einstein's thought process about not being able to solve a problem using the same tools that caused it, then I had to get people out of a particular thought mode. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the things I would have to say would create what's known as cognitive dissonance. And you know those terms, if you run into them yourself. And so, so I had to put people at ease, you know, and give them a little bit of humor so I can give them a little bit of information, technology, and so forth. So then along about 2004, decided to get serious about it. And so at that point, we started Solutions in Commerce, started doing seminars, workshops, and so forth. Since that time, we've done a multitude of seminars and so forth in the United States, in Canada, until the Canadians finally got fed up with me and wouldn't let me back in the country anymore.
Really?
Oh, no. They said, don't come back. We'll put you in jail. I said, okay, I don't like it up here. It's too cold anyway.
Especially from the South.
Oh, yeah. Listen, tell me. And then we had been in Australia probably 4 or 5 times, in New Zealand. Probably the most significant seminar we did. We did a seminar in London, England.
Nice.
Oh, yeah, that was fun because we were right. We might go over some of that story a little bit later on from a metaphysical point of view, because there are certain things that came as a result of that which are very, very significant in the total picture when we start to talk about fixing the financial matrix. And so we had a little bit of activity there subsequent to that seminar and so on. So in general, been very well received with the things we have. I've met some of the most excellent people all across the planet as a result of our travels and so forth. So it's been a good experience for me. I've gotten a lot out of it. I hope that other people have gotten a lot out of it, because otherwise, why would I do it? So
yeah, of course. Well, I mean, in your travels, what do you find as being the hottest impedances and issues for the citizens of the world today?
Mind control.
Absolutely.
One of the advantages that I have is it's very hard to put mind control on me. One of the things, what I studied in when I was at university was psychology. And when I first went to school, I thought I was going to be studying classical Freudian stuff, you know, and all that.
Yeah.
And then when I got there, the only thing they were teaching was behaviorism, you know, behavior modification and all that kind of stuff. But since I was so very well trained in the techniques of mind control, it's pretty easy for me to identify it when I see it. And so that was the benefit of that education, so to speak. But as I go around to talk to the various people and so forth, you know, I see the mind control. So then my goal is to give them at least one different way of looking or thinking about something. And if I can do that, I can put a crack in the mind control. And then once that crack is there, then we can start to spread that crack bigger and bigger so that people can come out from under that. And so a lot of people, you know, look at what we have to say, boy, that's the craziest thing I ever heard of. And to them it is, if you're in that state of mind. But for others who have, a little bit more of an open mind about some of it, then they start to see through some of the problems, and then, you know, whole new horizons open up. So that's a good thing.
Well, I noticed that you're going to be throwing a workshop at eSETI weekend of September 4th through September 6th. So, folks, please do me a favor. Go up to the eSETI site. You can also reach it at privateinvitationeSETI.com and get all the details. This is going to be an extremely informative workshop with Winston, hands-on. I can't think of a better opportunity. If I had the ability, I would go. And it's called Removing Commercial Karma, which I just love. I love that title. Can you tell us just a little bit about what you'll be covering there?
Yeah. It's going to be fun to be up there at the ranch. For those of you who have experienced it, being there, it's an interesting place in as much as there's a couple of natural ley lines that intersect right there at that spot, huge energy vortexes, stargates, all kinds of things. I mean, they got spaceships flying over all the time. And if you're not real careful, you might get a Bigfoot to sneak up on you or whatever.
That's true.
Anyway, it's the place itself is very stimulating and mind opening, and so we're really looking forward to doing that seminar there. Now, the basic subjects is the first major session we'll have on Saturday. Well, let me just say on Friday afternoon, there will be an afternoon session for, we've kind of just advertised it as for people who might be new to the information. Then we intend to have a Friday afternoon get to know your subject matter kind of thing. So I'm not really sure exactly all the things we'll talk about there. It depends on who comes.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then Friday evening, we always have a little kind of get-together. It's kind of for my benefit.
Yeah,
and that is,
yeah.
I get a chance to, I just ask, you know, just have people say, ask me any question you want to ask about anything.
Cool.
And I do that so I can gauge the audience. Because, you know, once I know what kind of questions they can formulate, then I know how deeply they're thinking about some of the subject matter. So on Friday night, we have kind of just an open forum kind of thing. And then coming on Saturday morning, then we get serious. So the Saturday morning subject matter will have to do more with history. In other words, how do we get into the fix we're in? And so, and there's quite a bit to that. So we'll go over some of the history, try to bring things up to date to show how we got into the problems and circumstances that we find ourselves with. And then Saturday afternoon, this should be of interest to a lot of people, and that is we're going to have a discussion about money. I have found, and some of my other friends have found, that people have absolutely no comprehension about money, what it is, where does it come from, is there more than one kind, and so, and it's important. It's so very important in our modern commerce to understand the nature of money, how it's created, all those kind of things, and so people take money for granted.
Yes.
They take money for granted and don't understand about it. And in particular, when you get the interaction between the private side and the public side, and people try to intermix the different kinds of money, there's where they have the problems. And so certainly in the Saturday afternoon discussion, we'll be talking about the different kinds of money and resolutions of public problems using public money rather than cash. A lot of people don't understand that. So that would be a good session. I think people get a lot out of that.
Oh, absolutely.
And then Saturday night, of course, everybody go out to James. They'll have a sky watch, you know, watch the ships go over and so forth. That's always pretty good fun.
Yeah, it is.
Except
we saw a ton of ships, by the way, everybody.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're all over the place up there.
A ton.
Yeah. I've seen so much of that, you know, that I tell everybody, you know, first off, I go to bed early. I try to get in bed, but now
I know that because I shared the house with you and Pat. You know, it was like we had to really be quiet because you guys go to bed so early.
I do. She doesn't. Anyway.
That's good.
I tell everybody, well, if the ships land and somebody gets out and asks for me by name, come wake me up. Otherwise, you know, don't even bother me. No, that's pretty good fun up there. All right, so that'll be Saturday night. And then Sunday, the thing we wanted to go into is establishing the claim, which is an important concept because it plays very well into what we'll be going into Sunday afternoon. And so certainly during the morning session, we'll be talking about things such as, you know, UCC financing statements. So we'll be going into a little bit of technology to help people to understand how things are, because a lot of people don't understand that our present court system is all based upon admiralty procedures, so forth. And in every situation in the admiralty, the real question is who has the claim on the collateral that's in question?
Mm.
That's the real question when you get into an admiralty situation. So establishing the claim is one of the prime elements of any kind of situation like that, because when we get into Sunday afternoon, we're really going to get into this business of the claim and removing that commercial karma. So some of the technology that we'll be working on Sunday morning will play well into the subject matter for Sunday afternoon.
Awesome.
Which has to do with the assignment of reversionary interest, and then also the authentication process. Now, let me just explain to people. There's a lot of misunderstandings, perhaps, about some of this. But anyway, as we'll show in our history class on Saturday morning, this all plays into that. But as we find, you know, certain situations were created with our birth, and there are actually two things that happened. One which is very good, and the other which is very bad. But in the first instance, there was a what's known as a foreign sited trust, which was created, and in that trust situation, we were given an exemption from taxation. Now, that's an important concept. So in the first instance, we were given an exemption from taxation. Our birth documents and so forth were sent through the Department of Commerce, and bonds were created to guarantee our debt. Now, That was the first situation, which was a very good situation when you're in commerce. But the second problem was we were tricked. People were tricked. And that was that they were tricked into a situation known as Social Security Insurance. And that's not so bad when you just take a look at it, with the exception that we were required to sign the particular document known as an SS-5 form. And in that, we basically subrogated all of our rights and defenses in the original trust over to a Sestakay-Vi situation. Now, I know I'm using words here people not listening, aren't familiar with, but at the seminar, we'll familiarize with words. But anyway, what we basically did was we signed away our rights and defenses in the original trust into a Sestakay-Vi situation, the result of which we became construed as the trustee for the all capital letter name that you find on the birth certificate. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it depends on your point of view. I have found 99% of the people do not know how to act as a trustee in that situation.
And they're hoping to be a beneficiary.
They're hoping to be.
Yeah.
Well, they were the beneficiary on the original trust, but in this case here, they turned into a trustee. And that's what causes the problem, because number one, they don't know how to act like a trustee in that situation and would better be suited as a beneficiary. And we can reverse those things. So as part of our Sunday afternoon endeavor, we'll be showing the reversal of those things, the assignment or the reassignment of the fiduciary-trustee relationship. We're going to send it back to where it came from, so you're not under that onus of being the trustee, so you can truly be a beneficiary.
That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. That's what I call releasing commercial.
I wish I could come.
Well, wow. It'll be recorded. We'll finally get to it, you know. And then the second portion of it is the one that I'm really interested in projecting as far and wide as I possibly can, which has to do with the authentication process of the long-form birth certificate, and then showing you how to develop that in such a way that you can become the owner of your body. Now, in our past system with the pledge system that started, you know, back in the 30s and whatnot, our labor or the result of our labor has been pledged to the national bankruptcy. Now, of course, that ended in 1999, but nobody told anybody.
Right.
But we knew about it. But anyway, when that period of time was over with, then we were free, but most people didn't know it. And so the system, as it were, dating all the way back into the 1400s, mind you, back in the 1400s, the Vatican actually created a trust, whereas they claimed the bodies of the people.
Whoa.
Yeah, see, they first set up the first, you know, you have to go all the way back to 1213 when King John, or, you know, idiot King John, gave the kingdom to the Pope on the basis that he was a sinner. So he, to redeem his sins, he gave the Vatican the whole world.
Which means he was a sinner, meaning he was indebted to
well,
right?
Yeah, he was going with that same mystical theology that they had developed over the centuries. And so King John became convinced that he was a sinner, needed to repent. And so the Pope said, okay, we will forgive you your sins, just give us all your property, which he did. And so then the Vatican created the Sestakay-Vi trust situation where they claimed the whole planet, you know, wherever they went, they put a flag up, you know, and we claim this for the king / Vatican. Read history, it's all in there. But anyway, then the second go-around with the Sestakay-Vi trust, what they did was they claimed the bodies of the people because the bodies came from the ground. So anyway, if you go that far back, you know, you see what's happened. And so in our present system, it's this continuation of the same thing, is that the government claims the bodies of the people. And that's why they come in and take children.
Oh my God. I'm just, the other thing I'm tripping out on is you know, like the Catholic process is basically asking for to give you the body and blood.
Yeah.
As part of the, you know, I mean, this all is so intertwining. It's unbelievable.
Well, they kind of got mixed up a little bit. We're trying to help them straighten out. But in any event, when you come down into our present circumstance, as we have it now, that same thought process is very relevant because, again, you know, we got, you know, people come and say, well, give us these children. You know, we'll take these children or we'll take people and put them in the military, have them go kill people because the system thinks they own the bodies.
Okay,
that's what they think. Now, so some of the technology that we've been working on here will demonstrate and show people how to come in and own your body, your body is just dirt and water is all it is. It's real estate. It's just real estate that happens to get up and walk around and talk. But in any event, they claim that, so now we're going to show you how to undo that and create the necessary documents that demonstrate that you own the body. And then having done that process, then we show how to go to the one world government, as it were, and with a change of status. Now, most people in the United States are listed at on the files. They're listed as U.S. citizens. Now, people need to go study that pretty close. But in essence, what that means is that your status is as a fictional 14th Amendment citizen.
Of a corporation,
yeah. You're a common stockholder in the corporations, all you are. So that's your present status. Now, because of that status, you're also an enemy of the state. When we have our history review on the Saturday morning, I'll show you how the after World War II, the Trading with the Enemy Act was converted and amended in such a way that all of the people who were U.S. citizens now become enemies of the state. And in consequence of that, the term that's generally used to describe us is enemy combatants. So we're at war with the U.S. federal government. And that's why they can come kick your door in or do anything they want to do because you're an enemy combatant. And if they shoot you, down the street, they'll get away with it.
See? That's crazy.
Oh, it is crazy.
You know, I was going to ask you just to kind of back up a little bit. I've listened to quite a few of your interviews, and one of the things that really got my interest was you were saying that admiralty law goes all the way back to Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'll put that here on my list, but let me finish out with this one thought process before I go back to that.
He has a list.
Well, as we go along here, I'm kind of taking notes to make sure that I clarify. I don't want to leave people hanging, you know, with some of the descriptions. But anyway, once we have reestablish that ownership and give that information to the commissioner of the Internal Revenue who holds the master file. Your status on the master file will change from U.S. citizen to non-resident alien. Now you're back in the same position you were in with that original foreign situs trust, where your exemption from taxation means something. Because now we're going to put you, because a non-resident alien is a non-taxable status. Now,
very cool.
So that's a pretty good position. And we'll be going over that. And then in conjunction with that, I believe that we have finally arrived at a solution to the mortgage foreclosure problems using the same technique.
Fabulous.
Yeah, I was given basically an international commission back in 2010 from the underwriters of the mortgages. All of your mortgage banks and everything are underwritten by what's called the collateral accounts. And so the man who was the sole guy who had the sole responsibility for those things, he was very upset. And so I visited with him there in Cambodia in 2010. And he said, you know, it's an embarrassment. He said, it's an embarrassment to us what's going on in the United States because of all these mortgage foreclosures. And he says, we underwrote all of those loans. And he said, we're not altogether happy about it. So he said, Weston, what I want you to do, I want you to go back to the United States. And I said, I want you to represent us in this matter and get this mortgage thing cleaned up. I said, well, okay, that's a pretty big job. And so anyway, I could go into a little bit more of the history of that. But anyway, in conjunction with that responsibility that was given to me almost over 5 years ago, and we tried a lot of different things. I could go into history of that. But anyway, in conjunction with that, I believe at this point, using this technology, I believe that we have the solution to these mortgage foreclosures and to a mortgage period. And so at the seminar that ESETI, I've addressed this before, so I try to get as much exposure to this concept as possible. But I believe on Sunday evening, as the capstone, as the icing on the cake, I'm going to demonstrate that particular technique using the technology that we've used to build up to that. So that's a pretty good one. So really looking forward to it. So that'd be Sunday evening, and then Monday I will be hanging around if anybody wants to, you know, a private consultation about particular problems they might have. I'll be there. Until everybody gets through, I guess, on Monday for that. So that pretty much wraps up that schedule. Do you have any questions about that schedule or any points of it? And then I can go on to the Adam and Eve story if you want to.
No, I don't. But I just want everyone to understand that this is a whole nother piece and layer of us truly capturing and reattaining, I should say, our sovereignty. So check it out definitely again. Make sure you go up to the ESETI website. And again, it's private invitation, ESETI.com. And you'll see it right up there. It's Friday, September 4th through Sunday or Monday, September 6th or 7th. And Winston is just an amazing presenter of this kind of detail. And I think you'll be impressed. You know, there's an awful lot of information. So now, Winston, I would love to hear about how does Adamalty Law go back all the way to Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden?
Well, as I've mentioned, you know, as a young person, as a Sunday school attendee. Well, anyway, I went to Sunday school when I was a kid, and I was impressed by it. I mean, it just came naturally to me, I think, the study of the scriptures and the different things. And so those things stayed with me and still stay with me all through my life. And then when I got involved, especially in commercial redemption, what was obvious to me was that the basis of commercial redemption was, in fact, the King James Version of the Holy Bible. Now, let me emphasize King James Version.
Okay.
So it's not the Geneva Bible. It's not the Catholic Bible. It's not the lost books of the whatever. Okay, so it was what King James himself designated to be the authority. Now listen to this, the King James Version, was authorized for use in the churches and courts. Okay, that's very significant. Now, a lot of people don't realize who the translators of King James were. but the man who was in charge of the translation of King James was a man named Robert Flood. Robert Flood, at that time, was the Grand Master of the Priory of Zion, a secret society which had been set up to protect the Holy Bloodline. You can go study that one.
Interesting.
But they were closely aligned with
yes.
the Knights Templars.
Yes.
Now, the Knights Templars, go back and study their history, but they figure very heavily into our present commercial system.
Yes, they do.
So in consideration of these things, a study, or at least a working knowledge of King James Version of the scriptures would be very helpful. Now, the first story we hear about, in that model was the story of Adam and Eve. Now, a lot of people say, well, that's just an allegory, that's a metaphor, that's a fictional story. And other people say, no, it happened just that way. It don't make any difference. Whichever way you want to look at it is okay with me. But what I want to explain is the what happened. Now, according to the story, according to the story, God had created a man and a woman. Trust me, I know about woman, having dealt with your kind before. Just joking. Now, okay, so the Adam and Eve story basically centers around the creation of a man and a woman put into a situation of innocence, as it were. And while they're in that state of innocence, they were given certain commandments or instructions about how they were to conduct themselves, or else there would be consequences if they did not function in the way that they had been instructed. All right. But they got put into a double bind. You know what a double bind contract is? It's, damned if you do and damned if you don't. Right. And so on the one hand, he says, multiply and replenish the earth. And then on the other hand, he says, don't you be over here eating off that tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So you got Adam scratching his head, and Eve scratching her head, and say, well, what's this all about? So anyway, in consequence of whatever happened, whether it was a serpent or whatever, anyway, certain knowledge came into their minds and their activity and so forth. Now God had told them, according to the story, God had told them that if you go out here and if you do this, he said, in that day I will surely destroy you. Oh. Which meant he was going to take them out of existence. Okay, so there's a little bit of fear going on here already. All right. Now, I won't go into all the details. There's a lot of, deep mysteries in some of this. But anyway, they went and ate that apple from that tree or whatever. And God found out about it, come along and said, uh-oh, you guys got a problem. Now, according to his own word, he would have had to have destroyed them at that point, but rather than do it at that time, okay, he put them into a new jurisdiction. In other words, they were in one jurisdiction, which was God's law, God's court. And so he removed them from that jurisdiction into another jurisdiction, which we would typically call admiralty. Now, the reason why I would say we call it admiralty is because when he cast them out of the garden and put them out into the lone and dreary world, he said, okay, he said, while you're out here, he said, you'll have the opportunity to repent. Those are kind of theological words. In our commercial world, we would call that reorganization. Now, a reorganizational bankruptcy is you can continue to do business as usual with the hope that if you successfully operate the bankruptcy, that you can restore your business to its normal function. So from a commercial lingo that we would use, we would say that they were taken out of one jurisdiction, put it, because bankruptcy only exists in the Admiralty. That's where it's at. That's why I say Admiralty. All right, so Adam and Eve were put into the Admiralty jurisdiction into a reorganizational bankruptcy so that they could correct whatever thing had happened. And then once they had made that correction, then they could be taken back into the original jurisdiction. All right. Really? Now, it might take, 4,000 years for them to get there. But in any event, that was the original plan that was set up. So that's pretty much how we have patterned our commercial activities. Certainly, a lot of people don't realize this, but the United States of America have always been in bankruptcy. Always.
Yes.
Right from the days of the Articles of Confederation. And then in the 1871 period, they set up a shadow government, a federal corporation, continue the bankruptcy until you get down into, Representative Trafficante from Ohio. He got right up in front of Congress and said it. He said, we're involved in the largest Chapter 11 bankruptcy in history.
And I remember that. And in fact, that was one of my questions to you, which is, how many bankruptcies have we been through? I noticed that you said that we go through this every 70 years. So how far back does this go? When was the first bankruptcy for the United States?
The first bankruptcy was in fact the Articles of Confederation.
Not before that.
Well, they could have been, but what they did was the colonists, the states. Before they were colonists, they were sovereign states. And so anyway, the 13 states / colonies decided to combine their debts into an aggregate corporation, and the Articles of Confederation were simply the corporate bylaws of that corporation operating in bankruptcy because they couldn't pay it or didn't want to pay it. So the reason why they went into bankruptcy was to protect the sovereign states from the creditors. Creditors being the Crown, the Bank of England, East India Trading Company, all that bunch. So there were a lot of creditors that would have liked to have taken control of North America as it was at that time. But in order to prevent the creditors from coming in and seizing the assets, then they went into a bankrupt situation using the Articles of Confederation as the bylaws for the corporation, which was operating in bankruptcy. Now, after the Revolutionary War, there were more and more debts. And so, sometimes I hate to get into this history because I really can't say what I want to say, but in essence, what happened to protect the investments of many who had invested in the Revolutionary War, they created another document to go along with the Articles of Confederation, which was in fact the Constitution for, now listen to that word, for, the Constitution for the United States of America. Now, it was simply no more or less than the continuation of the bankruptcy again, to protect the assets away from the creditors and so forth.
So, Winston, are you saying that the main difference between the Constitution and the Articles of Confederation was really just merely another bankruptcy contract?
Yeah, it was kind of a continuation with this exception, and that is that many of the founding fathers, who are known as We the People, who bankrolled the Revolutionary War, now they also became creditors. And so part of the reason for the Constitution for the United States of America was a hope on the part of some of the investors in the Revolutionary War to make good on their investment. And so the Constitution for the United States of America was a document that was created by the Scottish Rite Freemasons, most of whom had participated and invested in the revolutionary process, many of whom were hoping to recoup their investment, because they had made considerable investment. I mean, I think Washington himself is just about bankrupt. And history is terribly misunderstood.
Yeah, it's very convoluted. And I think you had said once before up at ESETI that everything is upside down.
Yes.
You know, everything that you see is not what it appears to be, and especially in legal matters. Now, that leads me to my next question, which is, can you clarify simply, because you're really good at that, the distinction between common law, constitutional law, maritime law, trust law, admiralty law, and Roman law? Because these are the seven that are kind of tossed out there all the time. I think it gets people confused. Some of them may be one and the same, but I wanted to hear what you had to say.
Okay, I will address that if you give me about 10 more minutes on the bankruptcy issue, because I didn't.
Absolutely.
Okay, all right, so that's the next one we'll go to here. I'm taking notes.
Okay, good.
All right, but to continue on with the concept of bankruptcy as it relates to the Constitution for the United States of America, international bankruptcies last for a period of 70 years. That would be 70. And so the first period of bankruptcy started with the public acceptance, perhaps, of the Constitution for the United States of America in 1789. And then if you'll trace 70 years from that, you come up to 1859. Mm. And there were serious considerations at that time because the debts had not been paid. Even though they'd been into bankruptcy for 70 years, the debts had not been paid. And in consequence of that, it was contemplated that it needed to go into another 70-year period of bankruptcy, which kind of ticked off the Southerners, because they all had freehold land, and they did not want their land subscribed as the security in a bankruptcy. So they got into a fight about it. I mean, the Civil War had very little to do with slavery, but it had to do with state rights and the freehold land in the South. Anyway, that's a lot. But anyway, so they went into another 70 years of bankruptcy at that time, which brought us down to 1929. What happened about that period of time?
Yeah, only the most major crash of all time.
Things here, and then because the two periods of bankruptcy prior to that had not satisfied the creditors, they contemplated a third period, and that third period of bankruptcy is very instrumental in that was the introduction of slavery. Now, people get their words mixed up. What happened in the earliest of times with the people from Africa, the Irish, the Chinese, and so forth, they were involved in involuntary servitude. But slavery is not that. Slavery is voluntary. And so in consequence, it's an Old Testament concept. So in consequence of the situation from 1929 on, they set up a system. It's called the pledge system. We could go into that sometime again, but anyway, a system was set up to introduce slavery into the bankruptcy so that the bankruptcy could be paid off. And we did, using the pledge system. We did, in fact, pay off that bankruptcy so that in 1999, after three periods of international bankruptcy, the people came out from under the debt. And Bill Clinton himself, man, if Bill Clinton ever told the truth, this would be the only time I ever heard of it. He got right there on television. He said, I'm the last United States president. And he was.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bush, he was just the CEO, and same thing with Obama. He's just the CEO of a corporation. So that ended the obligation that was structured under the common law. Now, so you want to get into a little bit of this common law and admiralty comparison and so forth.
Well, and also the execution versus
operation.
Cooperation, right?
No, operation.
Operation.
Yeah, I can talk about that just here in a minute. But what I wanted to point out is that under the common law, the children are liable for the debts of the parents. That's common law concept. And so, for instance, in my case, my ancestors came to North America in 1752, and they participated in all these things we've talked about. So in that respect, I was liable for, under the common law, I was liable for the debts which had been incurred and not paid off by all of my ancestors, but I did, and many of us did, you know, kind of as a general overview. All right, so that satisfied the requirements then of the common law. And then on the other side of the equation, after the Civil War, there was a new federal corporation set up in Washington, D.C., and they went into their own bankruptcy. They went into their own, which eventually, you know, as we talked about here a moment ago, stimulated Mr. Trafficante to get up and say what he said, which got him a nice long jail term, by the way. But in any event, that is the form of that bankruptcy is a Chapter 11 reorganization for corporations. And so that corporation was operating a Chapter 11 up until here just recently, when the United States Incorporated has been taken over and is in receivership. And we have a new republic form of government in operation in Washington, D.C. right now, even as we speak.
So you do agree that that did take place? Do you agree that it took place December 21st of last year?
Well, they had actually set that up and had it in place for a number of years. As I understood it, they were stationed in West Virginia. But I've known about that for a very long time.
Yes.
And so they were waiting the opportunity to come forward. So that now they have come forward. And as I understand it, they're in complete control. And they will make those announcements probably, don't quote me, but probably at the fall equinox. The only thing that was holding them back was the Basel III agreements, required that they have a substance backing for their currency, and there's no gold in Fort Knox. I mean, everybody knows that.
Yeah, everybody knows that.
But about 5 months ago, 4 or 5 months ago, the Chinese elders leased about $100 billion in gold to the new republic. So now they have the gold back. Yeah, that happened about, I can't remember, 4 or 5 months ago. Anyway, so now they have everything that's necessary to complete the picture. So I would suspect that the new currency would probably be announced on the equinox this fall. And then, as I understand it, you know, they have produced some instructional videos that they'll be running nonstop on the networks to explain to the American people what's happened. This is not a military coup.
Right.
This is an interim government in place to get a constitutional republic reformed. And so we got a lot of work to do here in the coming.
You know, Winston, not to interrupt you, but I got to ask you, we've been noticing that all the cop cars in this area, and a lot of them are sheriffs, they have a new car out, and all the windows are blacked out.
Yeah, could be.
And we just thought that was awfully coincidental to what is going on with the political and legal systems right now.
Well, it's going to take a while. Like I tell people, you know, we've had about 70 years of vomit. Now it's going to take just a little while to get that mopped up.
Sure.
And what we need is everybody to pitch in and help clean it up.
Yes.
So if you just leave it, you know, to a few people, I mean, that's a big burden. But if everybody gets educated, understand what's going on, and if everybody's willing to pitch in and help, then we get it cleaned up ever so much faster. But it will get cleaned up. There's no getting around it.
Well, and I know that you say all the time, very consistently, if the system is not broken, why fix it?
Yeah.
And many people kind of get repulsed by that statement. But in fact, I think what you're really trying to say, and many people have alluded to this, we don't have time to just start a whole new system over. What we do need, however, is a house cleaning to remove all of the evil and the goo and
yeah.
the disgust that is running this planet. That
yeah.
we have time to do. And that was one of my questions to you, which you speak a lot about, is freeing up the heritage funds for the planet. And
yeah.
I really want to make sure we have time to discuss that today.
I could discuss it a little bit, but more key to it than anything else, if you want to talk about prosperity, the key to prosperity is allowing people to keep what they earn. Now, right now, people are being taxed at an exorbitant rate, and so they're not willing to produce.
Right.
They're not.
Right.
I mean, they've just taxed people to the point that they have no reason to go to work.
Well, it's not even just that, Winston. It's also that they're exhausted with the number of hours they have to work to even make a reasonable wage to support their family.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So if we could get that now, a lot of people don't understand this, but we're the only country on the planet that does not have its own national currency. Federal Reserve notes are international currency. So with this new interim government coming in and the production of a currency, some people say it's going to be called Treasury Reserve notes, but in any event, it will be non-interest-bearing currency. And so that does away with the Federal Reserve interest. It also does away with the IRS. So if we get rid of the IRS, get rid of the taxing agencies and all this flim-flam operation they've been running on us all these years, then the people will prosper. And then if there are huge amounts of assets that are available for the infrastructure, then that would be good. Now, people got in their mind, you know, when all this money becomes available, they're going to get $1 million in their bank account. Don't hold your breath. It ain't going to happen that way. The money is designated for the infrastructures and
yes.
for that kind of thing, and not for people to become overnight millionaires and go lay on the beach, you know, drinking, you know, mint juleps or whatever. All right. So,
well, it doesn't make any sense either, because they've already done a lot of studies with people that have won lotteries who had absolutely no prosperity consciousness, or, you know, all they were was like desperate to get from underneath their bills and their liabilities, only to find out that within 5 years they were completely stone broke. And now I think it's even shorter period than that. So why would we go through all this effort to put the money in the hands of all these people where none of us have been adequately educated on how to handle money?
Yeah, most people can't even handle $1,000. Why would you give them $1 million?
Exactly.
So, but that, you know, that's a sociological problem.
Yeah. Along with all the others.
Well, it has to do with our, you know, with the way we look at things and whatnot. But when you start talking about, you know, care for the old and the aged, I'm getting there. And, you know, the really bad way that we've treated old people, the veterans, I mean, we got
big
people
time.
Living in slums, we got people living in cardboard boxes all across the country. That has to come to an end, and we will put it to an end. But you know, again, those are more along the lines of sociology. One of the first things that had to be fixed, and this is why I've been working. I work with St. Germain, too. Anyway, one of the things that St. Germain had, well, I shouldn't say, he's been working on this for centuries, literally. I mean, if you go all the way back to the World Trust in 1625, that's how long he's been working on this process.
Yeah, he's an amazing being.
And so when you get down to our present time, he is, in fact, the head guy, the director, whatever you want to call it, of the Age of Aquarius. I mean, Jesus had that responsibility during the age of Pisces.
Yes.
Now we got Aquarius. We're in Aquarius.
Yes, we are.
And Saint Germain was given that responsibility in 1954. That's when he got to be the head guy in Aquarius. So certainly the main thing that he has labored is the fixing of the financial matrix. That's what his main goal is. Now, that's the first thing that had to be corrected. The second thing that had to be corrected was the court and the judicial systems, and that's the responsibility of Lady Portia.
Yes.
You know, Portia is his twin flame, so they work together.
Yes.
But those are two of the main things that have been worked on so strenuously in these last number of years. And I think we just about have the financial matrix to where it can't go, where it can't fail. Next thing is we got to get this crazy court system fixed. And we're doing it. We're doing it little by little. And so all these things will have to be handled, which plays right into your question about all these crazy law forms you addressed. So shall we go into that before
I have a gazillion questions for you, so we may go over time. If you have the time, I'll make the time.
Hey. Okay, I've got time. All right. Now you had mentioned a lot of different words, you know, common law, admiralty law, and all kinds of different kinds of law. What I want to emphasize is this, that law is way down the road. Now, the first thing that people have to consider is not law. They have to consider contract. All right. Contract is the thing that causes people to interact. In other words, without a contract in place, people simply wouldn't interact with other people.
Right.
As a general rule. But in any event, so we first need to look at the contract. Now, if the parties to the contract are satisfied with the results, the contract is executed, it's over with, down the road we go. All right? Now, but if some party to a contract goes into breach of contract, then we have to have a way to resolve that problem. Now, that's what's called law. Law is the remedy for a breach of contract. So before we start talking about the different styles or the different venues and jurisdictions of law, then we would have to go back and look to see what contract does that law apply to. So when you start talking about, you know, your basic elements of law, common law, equity, as they call it, admiralty, and all those kind of things, the question is, does one law apply to a contract, you know, that's in a different venue? And the answer is no, it doesn't. Now, what they did, in our country at least, back in the, 60s and 70s, was they combined the procedures, the court procedures for the three main law forms, which were common law, equity, and admiralty. They combined the procedures into one form, which is known as the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And so to get a remedy for a common law contract, to get a remedy for a contract in equity, or to get a remedy for an admiralty contract, then you would use the same set of rules. Mm. So people get confused about that. Mm. So you can still get the same remedies, which were always available under those contracts, but you'll have to use a specific set of rules and procedures to get that remedy. So those three law forms were combined into one system, but the remedies are still available if you use the procedures correctly. That's what we're talking about. So we have some people that are very well versed in, for instance, common law, Equity, not so much, but then Admiralty. Actually, Admiralty is my favorite place. Admiralty is all about contracts and so forth. And so that's and by the way, Admiralty is the easiest jurisdiction to function in. Oh, yeah, it is. Once you understand it. Because in our present bankruptcy, in our present reorganizational bankruptcy, we're involved with negotiable instruments. And they're very easy to use. When I first started studying commerce and so forth, it was recommended to me that the first thing that I should study was negotiable instruments. And so I did. I sent away for a correspondence course in negotiable instruments. This is so far back. I mean, part of it came on cassette tapes. Remember those?
Oh, yeah. Still have them.
We've kind of got past that at this point. A lot of your listeners might not even know what that is.
That's true.
But anyway, I got this course that had some written material. A good part of it was lectures on cassette tapes. And I got me one of those little cassette players, and I'd carry that cassette player around. I'd listen to that stuff continually until I finally got it into my mind that I at least halfway understood it. And so that has served me very well, because when I look at different things, for instance, when I see a court case, what do I see? I see a negotiable instrument. And how do you deal with the negotiable instruments? See, we have that negotiable instrument law that we deal with. And so that probably has led me to a lot of the solutions, you know, in commerce that we devise based on negotiable instruments, because that's all we use.
Right.
And so that was really fundamental to my education. So rather than... Anyway, rather than try to dissect the various law forums that we have available, people should go back and look at the original contract to see what that was and see whether or not they have abided by their contract. And if all parties abide by their contract, there is no law, because there's no breach.
Okay, but wait a minute. So, you know, for example, the birth certificate, I, as an infant who is born, I did not make the conscious choice to go and get a certificate of birth. My parents did. So how can I claim that that was a mutual contract between myself and the agency that's overseeing or registering that certificate of birth?
Because that thought process is under the common law. And so your parents could act on your behalf as a minor.
True.
And then once you reach the age of majority, then you can decide how that's going to work out. And certainly usually by the age of 18 years, most people are so confused they don't know which way's up. But the process that I had talked about that we're going to present on Sunday afternoon at East City is in fact what a 18-year-old should do. Now, in that respect, for instance, five or six months ago, there was three of the native chiefs. They were trying to do some international business with China or something, and they requested that I assist them because I am an international notary. And they thought, if I notarize their stuff, it might have some extra weight or whatever. And I'm not into business. I don't know anything about business or whatever they're doing, but I was happy to accommodate them. So they came to where I was, and one of the chiefs of the Lakota Sioux, his wife came with him. And so when they were talking their business back and forth, you know, which is completely boring to me. I'm not a businessman. I don't understand any of that stuff. Don't care to. So I was talking to her about circumstances on the reservation and whatnot. And she had told me that that the government was continually coming in and taking the children.
Yes.
Again, those children were a part of the system. And so the government had every right to come and get them, just like Child Services does out here every day in your neighborhood. Okay, so she was complaining about that, and I said, well, I think I have a way here that would be that would put a stop to that. And I said, and if you work it correctly, I believe you can go get the other children back. And that was, I showed her the authentication process to where they could own the body.
Wow.
So that precludes any other claim in admiralty that any other corporate entity would make, because again, the ownership is on the private side, or what we would call common law. And so that precludes any adhesion contract that might come in from the admiralty side. So I explained that to her, and so she was going to go back and get to work on that. Now, does that apply to everybody? And the answer is yes. I continually hear things from people, you know, well, the government came in here and took my children, or come took my grandchildren or something like that for no good reason. They got them out here. You know, God only knows what happened to them. They put them out here in some pedophile's control. And people are really concerned about that. I mean, everybody's concerned about that, but yeah. Nobody seems to have the solution to the problem. But I think I do have the solution to the problem for parents or grandparents.
Right on.
Yeah, so now you can lock it up. You can change the status of the child from a U.S. citizen, number one, to a non-resident alien. Now you're holding the ownership document for the body. And so if you can demonstrate those things, then you got it locked down pretty tight. And so a lot of these things that we talk about, you know, have some very good applications. And I think we can resolve many of the problems that people face. But in answer to your question about not being able to sign a contract as a minor, again, we're going, you know, they're using the common law concept that a parent can obligate a child that's a minor. They can't do it if they're over the age of 18, but they can when they're a child. And so they do. But of course, it's by trickery and fraud and sleight of the hands and all that. I agree with that. But it's done. It's done all the time. They're doing it on the reservation. They're doing it in your neighborhood. And so we can put a stop to that. It's possible to put a stop to that. So these children do not get taken.
Winston, that's great news. And I was going to ask you, there's an awful lot of people, in fact, I've interviewed a couple, who are very, very passionate about trying to help save these children that are getting not only tortured, but satanically ritualed and all that. I guess my question is, you know, one of them is a huge proponent of common law, really, really pushing to know how to use common law. So how does that apply when we are under an admiralty law system?
To answer the question and to answer the situation, you have to use a combination of the whole thought process. Again, some of these things, you know, we deal with are what you would call common law, some of them in admiralty. But the overriding picture in everything is always going to be the original contract. And so in the case of a lot of people, what is the original contract that causes your problems with child services and some of these items? And it's the marriage contract. Now, prior to 1920 period of time, when people decided that they wanted to join as husband and wife, they had various procedures they would go through, usually from a religious institution, sometimes a judge or whatnot, but they did not do so under license. If you look up the definition of the word license, now listen carefully. Permission from the state to do something that is otherwise illegal, unlawful, or immoral. Okay? Now, that's what a license is for, is to do something that's otherwise illegal, unlawful, or immoral. So what's immoral about marriage? Right? Well, nothing, you know, right. Speak of.
Or about driving on a road.
Yeah, but let's not get into that. In any event, so when you go down and make an application, listen now, an application for a marriage license, there's certain requirements which must be met, and usually the license will be granted as a result of the application. All right? Now, anytime you see the word application, always think taxable event. Application equals taxable event.
Good.
Now, what is the tax on the license? It's the issue. It's the children. The children are the tax on the license. In commercial terms, what happens is called sexual commerce. And the issue from the sexual commerce is the tax on the license. Now, I hate to be so darn graphic with all that kind of thing, but that's exactly what it is. And so the root of the problem then is the original contract. The original contract is the application. That's what causes the taxable event. So, you know, when you start talking about, you know, some of the situations and circumstances you get into, can that matter be resolved at common law? The answer is no. There's no provision for that in common law. Mm-hmm. It has to be resolved within the admiralty. So you look at the marriage contract, if you will, as an admiralty contract, and if you address it and look at it that way, it might be a bit easier. Now, we can get past that contract. We can get past the circumstances involved with sexual commerce, with the ownership of the body through the authentication process that I talked about. But I continually have people, you know, email me or call me about, you know, we're getting a divorce, we're doing this, we're doing that. And I said, well, you know, I mean, they talk about different circumstances. I said, well, are you legally married? They said, yep. I said, okay, let's go back to the original problem. The original problem was you were tricked into getting into a marriage contract. They said, well, what's the trick? I said, they didn't tell you what they were going to do, did they? They didn't tell you they're going to take your children or whatever. You see, so it's fraud by omission, and it, under the common law concept, fraud vitiates all contracts. So I said, go back and deal with the original application before you do anything else. And I said, because if there's no contract in the admiralty court, it's all about contract. If there is no contract, it's a non-pros. I mean, there's nothing to talk about in the court if there's no contract. I said, first thing you do is go back and get rid of that original contract. And I said, then go from there. Then you can work things out however you think best. But in any event, you know, again, the hold that the state has is due to the license. Because, again, let me repeat the definition of a license. Permission from the state to do something. So a marriage contract is a three-party contract. Husband, wife, state. And even though a husband and wife may divorce, the state never goes away. So you have to get back to the original contract if you want to get anything done with that. That kind of makes sense.
Wow. Wow. Well, okay, so getting back to, isn't maritime law the same as admiralty law?
It didn't used to be.
Okay.
It has to do with money. There used to be a distinction between commerce and trade. Commerce was the king's business, using his money, and the maritime had to do with the merchants and the use of their money. But when the merchants started to use the king's currency, then commerce and trade melded together into one form. So now we don't distinguish in this day and age, because of the type of money we use, we don't distinguish between commerce and trade, and because it's all the same thing at this point.
So so you're basically saying, like, the merchants back then, they were probably exchanging one good for another, right?
There's a lot of history here. A lot of history. The merchant concept goes back to what's known as law merchant law, and that goes back way back into prior to 1000 AD kind of thing.
Wow.
It's a system that they had developed. It was a system used by the Knights Templars, and if you recall, when Norman the Conqueror came to England, the city of London held out and he was not able to overrun the city of London, so they got into basically a treaty that they would maintain their own law, merchant law, regardless of how the kingdom was run by William the Conqueror and all that bunch. So when you get down, you study the history of the merchants, you know, it's kind of a separate organization. They operated under substantive law, which is known as law of merchant law. Now it's been, pardon the expression, bastardized, because they've now certainly taken up uniform commercial code. You're using fiat currencies just like everybody else are. A lot of those historical markers, you know, have been basically lost and so forth. So it's more of a hodgepodge of stuff than it is anything else in our present time. But for all intents and purposes, the Admiralty and Maritime are the same thing.
Okay.
To answer your question.
So back to, I know you're going to be talking about authentication at this seminar.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, you know, how successful has that been thus far?
Real successful.
And how long have you been doing that for?
Well, I first presented that concept in October of last year at our a yearly Gardner seminar. And then we presented as far as we had it at that point.
Okay.
And then after that, as we developed more and more, then I re-presented it with the added technology in June at our Gardner seminar. And so then I started, well, it ain't just me. Let me put it that way. You know, I got my buddies. You
sure,
know, that I hang around
you have
with
your network that are supporting you in this whole thing, right?
Some of them guys are darn smart. I mean, I consider myself a midget when I start talking to other people. But anyway, over the period of time, we did expand upon the original concept of the authentication. And then we moved it into making the claim, making an appropriate claim to create the estoppel in the public. Maybe I can clarify that a little bit. But in any event, then we found out that the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue. Now, let me explain who the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue is. He's not in the IRS. The IRS and the Internal Revenue are two separate entities. The Internal Revenue was actually created in the Philippines back in late 20s, early 30s, because at that time they had anticipated making Philippines the seat of government for the one world government.
Interesting.
It ended up in New York.
Huh.
But at that time they had anticipated the one world government coming from Philippines, and they set it up in that way. And so to deal with the gold that had been leased to the Federal Reserve banks, they set up something that was known as the Bureau of Internal Revenue at Philippines. All right. So this Commissioner of the Internal Revenue, that's what his origin is. He's not associated with the Internal Revenue Service, even though there is a certain amount of intertwining with some of the functions. All right. With research, one of my friends found out that the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue holds the master file in regards to the status of the people. Mm-hmm. All right. Again, because of the SS5 form, then all of the original people became classified as U.S. citizens.
Correct.
And after the Trading with the Enemy Act, now they're all enemies. So he's holding the file on all the enemies, right? And then we found out that all of the agencies update their files at least once a month from the master file. We said, cool. So what we did, we went through the whole authentication process, Then we created ownership documents, created UCC1 financing statements, got those things recorded. And then I created a cover letter to send to the commissioner, basically telling him, hey, that's what, you know, we used to be this, but now we're this, and here's the proof of it. Here are the documents that have been recorded. We sent that to the commissioner, and then he changed this, you know, he changed my status, and the ones who had done this process, he changed our status to non-resident alien, which is a non-taxable status. Now, so one of my friends helped through this process. He had a bail, he's actually a retired policeman himself. But anyway, he went to one of his friends who's a bail bondsman and said, hey, go run my name. The guy come back and said, you don't exist.
Fantastic.
See, the all capital letter name had changed. It was gone.
Wow.
And another friend who had a friend in the FBI, he told him what he'd done, and the FBI guy said, yeah, he said you're out of the system. That's not exactly true. You're not out of the system, but you're not under the same status that you prior were prior to that time, because now you have changed into a status as a non-taxable entity, and in consequence, the word we would use would be American national.
Correct.
Now notice I did not say sovereign in there.
Right, right.
So we're not talking about sovereignty in this process here, but we are talking about changing your status to where you can't be taxed.
Are there any negative ramifications to it as far as receiving goods and services?
No.
Okay.
That question comes up continually about Social Security benefits. Okay. And I always tell people, I said, what you're thinking are Social Security benefits is old age pension. For instance, there's people don't know this, but the Social Security system is owned by the Queen of England. All payments you're making into Social Security go straight to the Queen over there so she can have a good time with all her friends.
So what about the fact that the Social Security system supposedly has been broke and non-existent?
It's always been broke. They never had any money. All the money went straight to the Queen, for crying out loud. So that's when people talk about what they're calling Social Security benefits. That's actually old age pension from the government, probably being paid out by the Department of Agriculture.
Interesting.
Because we're all just growing.
Ah, I thought you were going to say we're all chattel.
Well, you can use that word, but, you know, like one time my mother said, hey, she said, did you wash your face? I said, yeah, I sure did. She said, come here, let me inspect. So she grabbed my ear, looked behind my ear, and she said, there's enough dirt there to grow carrots. Get back in there. So it only makes sense then the Department of Agriculture be involved in it. Got to throw a little humor in there. Sorry.
Oh, God. Well, I had one person ask me, I mean, they were very familiar with you, and I forgot all the details as to what they pursued. But the question that they had brought up that they wanted me to ask you was, at what point can you succeed if you have to enter a court of law to get these sorts of things done? For example, I've read that the moment you walk into that court of law, you're in their jurisdiction.
When I walk into a court, they're in my jurisdiction.
Okay.
People got to get their heads straightened out. It's my court. It's your court. It's not their court. A lot of people people call me up sometimes and say, Winston, I got this court case going on over here and the judge is treating me like dirt. And I said, well, go fire him. They said, fire him. They say, you can fire the judge. I said, of course you can fire him. He works for you, doesn't he?
That's exactly what happened to this gentleman. He was very prepared, had all the information that he had learned from you and some others. And he said that the judge laughed him out of the courtroom. And when he came back in, his question was, how do you gain the respect of the judge, or how do you get into a position of authority with the judge? Since they're so corrupt, the majority of them are very corrupt.
Well, he should go back there and fire him. Just go back into the court, just say, for and on the public record, I'm firing Judge so and so. He'll get up and leave.
Really?
Yeah, I had a friend up in Washington State. He got into a civil thing. Now, it's a little bit harder in criminals, but anyway, he was in the civil court up there in Washington State, got into it. The judge wasn't acting right. He told the judge, well, you're fired. The judge got up to leave, and he asked him a question as he was going out, and the judge turned around, looked at him, and said, why should I answer your question? You just fired me. And he left. So they had to get a new judge. So that's the way it actually works. And so you fire a judge, and then just go tell the clerk, go find me somebody better than that last one, because I ain't putting up any more of this.
Wow. So it's really all about we stepping into our authority, even in the courtroom.
You better. If you don't, they'll simply just, beat you into the ground.
Wow.
I had a friend some years ago. It's in the criminal thing. Something's going on. I can't remember all the details, but it's in federal court. So he was in this federal court, and this judge was talking bad to him, He finally told the judge, he says, don't you ever talk to me that way in my court again. He said, don't you ever say, he got right after the judge. And the judge got up and left. Two U.S. Marshals standing there, They said, come with us. He thought the marshal was going to take him out back and beat him up or something, They took him back into the marshal's break room, said there's about 10 or 12 marshals back in there. So they all stood up and clapped their hands and said, we didn't like that SOB any more than you do. So you got to take charge of things.
I look forward to the day when this becomes so commonplace where everyone is knowledgeable enough to do this. I mean, it's just going to be such a day of glory.
Hi, everybody. Due to this interview running so long, it has been divided into parts 1 and 2. Join us next week for the second part of this interview with Winston Schrout, where he discusses gold, the revaluations, money, the closing of the central banks, the American national passport, and lots more. Same time, same place.